to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today.
There are several things that I hadn't thought of before until Nancy asked me two or three questions. And one threw me completely, which was about how my parents treated me and what impact that may have had on the way I brought up my kids. And that is something I hadn't really thought of. So there was some thought here that I was not anticipating, but I'm glad it happened.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. Priscilla Vang owns a payroll vault franchise in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is our sponsor for today's mentoring conversation. Priscilla discovered through helping clients find tax solutions that they need a payroll service they can count on. She's taken her client-focused skills, accountancy degree, and technology-driven software tools to help make sure business owners redefine how they do payroll. This saves time and money. Priscilla is passionate and dedicated to building trust over the long term with small business owners. With Priscilla, providing you with the best payroll service possible is what directs her life. You can reach her at 1-651-783-2509 or just click on the homepage button of wementor.com and you will see a button to directly connect you with Payroll Vault and Priscilla. So welcome to the program, everybody. In our conversation today, you will be hearing the journey of an entrepreneurial leader becoming an entrepreneur, Peter Beaumont. It's his journey. Intrapreneurship refers to entrepreneurial activity within a larger organization to create something new, like a new product or service or a new concept, or in Peter's case, Coca-Cola's re-entry into the Middle East after a 22-year absence for world domination, and a new distribution system for Philip Morris International, a leading tobacco company. Intrapreneurship typically represents an organizational level effort to organize and manage an internally generated venture. An advanced level of team building skills are needed to advance ideas and internally organize the new development. In an upcoming episode, I will be having a mentoring conversation with another entrepreneur, Art Fry, a former chemist with 3M. Art and Spencer Silver in 1974 invented the slightly sticky adhesive that is known as Post-it notes. So welcome to the studio, Peter.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Yes. How are you feeling today?
I'm good. Bit hot, but apart from that,
yeah.
Good. Mm-hmm.
And how about your feelings?
Oh, those. Well, see, we British keep our feelings undercover somewhat, but pretty good. I'm excited about being with you. Slightly new experience being in front of a microphone. Normally, I'm in front of a microphone in front of several people in an audience rather than listeners. So this is a new experience, and I'm curious as to how it's going to go.
Oh, good.
And particularly what you're going to ask me.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, good. Well, Peter Beaumont, for the audience's sake, is the founder and principal of ConXN Consulting. He's in the midst of revising a book he authored in 2014 called The Relationship Roadmap. The book is a 118-page comprehensive guide to building strategic relationships with clients. He is a global leader and marketer, an author and speaker, trainer, facilitator, coach, entrepreneurial operational system implementer, and a certified value builder. He's the team behind Your Team, focused on increasing the value of small size to Fortune 500 companies. He works with an owner through the process of being freed up from daily operations and allows visionaries to do what they do best, expand their reach. He is also running the Small Emerging Growth Companies organization in the Twin Cities, which is what I attend on a monthly basis. I really appreciate, Peter, how you run a really great meeting It's very energized and very focused. You help everybody with how to introduce themselves in a very pragmatic way, but very helpful to those who are, you know, just learning how to talk in front of a group or getting better at introducing yourself. So you're good at keeping things moving along. I appreciate that.
We like our timekeeping.
That's right. So to reinforce, so you are also, you've got a great website and you do a fair amount of blogging. And to reinforce the impact that blogging can have on your influence, I'd like to start by talking about a couple of blog posts on your ConXN website from December 21st, 2017. You generated a buzz from over 90,000 people, 1,000 shares, and over 200 comments with the post entitled, "The 7 Signs of Poor Leadership." In the comments, you noticed a common theme which prompted you to write the next article, entitled, "How to Know Whether You Are Not You're Self-Aware." Yeah, so you start with the definition of self-awareness that I would like to read to with your permission.
Go ahead.
Okay. I have paraphrased the definition and other behaviors you outlined because my listeners, they're very quick learners, and they're a pretty self-aware leadership group. Self-awareness is the conscious knowledge of one's own character, feelings, motives, and desires. This means taking into account the impact our behavior has on others. If we notice positive or negative effects, the self-aware person will think more deeply about why they're acting the way they are and use the opportunity to adapt his or her behavior. So here are 6 of the 7 signs of poor leadership that Peter mentions in his article, his blog. Bullying, being defensive, controlling, passive-aggressive, bombastic, which means when leaders are over the top and demonstrate how confident they are in their ideas, plans, business, and when their strategies defy objective reasoning or goals, don't pass the smell test. That's a sign they are overcompensating to appear like they have everything under control, and also making frequent excuses. You finished the article by writing, and I quote, "My second article coming soon will deal with ways we and others can force ourselves to be more self-aware. As Einstein is quoted as saying, if I had 1 hour to save the world, I would spend 55 minutes defining the problem and only 5 minutes finding the solution. We need to spend time defining the problem, and only then can we take steps to solve it." End quote. So for more articles, I will have your blog information at the bottom of the mentoring resources.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Well, let's get started because you have such an interesting background and you've traveled the world, really. You've worked in really large companies and you've got a wealth of experience as an entrepreneur. And then you forged your way into entrepreneurship here in the United States.
Yeah, I hadn't heard entrepreneur before until you demonstrated what it was the other day for me. So it was an interesting definition. Yeah. So I consider myself an entrepreneur now. Yes.
You do, huh? You're good at bringing people together and really making things happen.
Yeah. Thank you. And it has been a strength, I think, that's permeated throughout my life and my career. Somebody once said to me, it was actually in Moscow. He ran our division office up there, and he said, "Peter, you have a way with you that you treat everybody like they're your customer." And I thought it was quite. And I thought about that. I said, "Is he insulting me, or does he mean it?"
Yeah,
and then I
right.
realized that actually it was quite a compliment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, because it's relationship-based,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, which is what I was in that particular role, was a main part of what I did.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Well, very good. Let's kind of track back to your youth, because you've had some really difficult challenges to kind of overcome, and it sets kind of the framework for all the... For the rest of your career life, and where you are at today.
Yeah, it's been it's a hackneyed phrase, this, that's been a roller coaster, because it started very tough. It got, I think I then benefited from the early effort to put in and overcome those obstacles. Mm-hmm. And then it became not easy. I still worked extremely hard at what I did, but then it became tough again. So I've been through the first part was probably based on health issues, which I had to overcome. The determination in which I did that, I think, led to lots of success because I just wouldn't let go. And and then I think a number of other things came together to make it tough again, and I had to go through that again. So it's been an interesting time.
Okay, well, let's dig into the details, which is what I was afraid you
were going to ask.
Yeah, because you. Well, you were bullied for how many years?
Only a couple of years, yeah.
It was a couple of years, okay.
It was, bullying's never nice, so it probably seemed like longer than a couple.
Yeah. And one of the ways that you overcame it, which I thought was really funny in one of our conversations, was your mom, was it your mom who suggested you get into karate?
No, yeah, it's judo.
Judo,
so
yeah.
Close enough, yeah. I have no idea what the difference is. But, yes, I do, actually. Judo, you kind of pull people and push them around. With karate, you use your hands to, hammer them. But that's a very loose definition. But yes, they decided, but it was a family mum and dad thing, and let's make sure he can protect himself. So, yeah, I went to judo, and it was really interesting. It did harden me up, but the side benefit was that once people found out I'd done judo, they didn't come near me again.
So, so you didn't have to find out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. And the sickness that you were talking about, you were asthmatic and also you had eczema?
Yeah. I was born with infantile eczema, which you're not born with it, but it comes pretty quickly after you are born, all over the body. And at the same time, I was asthmatic. And so that combination is normally related to stress. And we never got to the bottom of what that was, but it stuck with me. I was very lucky. I grew out is probably the best expression that could be brought, that was thought of then. But at about 12 and 13, both my eczema improved greatly, and also my asthma started to vanish, and enabled me to play sport, which is of course one of the things I really wanted to do. So
yeah,
cross country running was a bit difficult with asthma.
Right. What other sports were you in?
Well, I played cricket, which is a sport that's seldom understood in this country, for good reasons. It's very different, and it's nothing like baseball. So I played cricket to a very high standard, thanks to my dad, who played to a very high standard too. He used to bowl and open the batting for Kent, which is like a state, but a very good state in England. At cricket. He also played rugby, which I took to as well when I was 12, 13. But I always loved soccer, so I started with that first. Oh. But I ended up playing basically those three sports, plus anything else I could handle. So later on, I took up basketball and then did track. I did quite a lot of sport, probably too much. Well, at least from an academic
perspective,
balance point of view.
I see. Yeah. You had a few.
My heart was on the field rather than in the...
In the books. Yeah, I see. Your mom was also an athlete too,
yeah,
right?
She played junior Wimbledon tennis, so she was very talented. And she used to take her two-week vacation at the time of Wimbledon so she could watch all of Wimbledon at home. The TV was on the whole time. And we had to get our own meals. So, forget
then for yourself.
It was a game on, you're on your own.
Okay. So you have one sibling?
My sister's 2 years younger than me, yes, Barbara. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And she's in New Zealand?
She is now. She married a Kiwi about, 30 years ago or so.
Okay.
Yeah, not the not the bird type, the New Zealand person type.
Yeah.
So, they got married and moved there shortly after they got married. And, she loves it down there. I've been down to visit her, obviously, quite a lot. And then my dad moved down there not long after my mum passed away. Oh. They used to both live in Spain, lived there for over 20 years.
Oh.
And so he moved down to be close to my sister, who had always been saying they ought to move down there. And he's been very happy down there. Mm. He's 96 now, so.
Okay.
Yeah. It still looks good.
Yeah. That's good. How did you found your career path? I think that's a pretty...
That's a interesting... Yeah. How far do we go on this? And I had three things I wanted to do, and they were not join the army or go on to fire engines or even join the police. They were journalism. They were teacher training, which was teaching sports at a high level for in schools, and business. Those were the three principal things I wanted to do. I had a fourth that sat out there, which was Scotland Yard. But I think what I really meant was James Bond. But I and I thought that was probably the stepping stone. But that was kind of
one of those dreams. Out.
No, not really. No, Bond. No, not really. Yeah. So those three. And you know, in England, you take, they still do, when you're about 16, you take O-levels, called ordinary levels. And we pass that on around the world. Many of the education systems around the world still adopt that, mostly. I think countries like Australia and South Africa still have adopted that system. And so you take O-levels at about 15 or 16, which helps you understand what you're going to stream into when you go into 17 and 18-year-old, into the next stage of sixth form. Sure. And so normally you take between six and eight of those. And normally you will get about five to seven of those. I got one.
Oh.
So obviously that wasn't a success by any stretch of the imagination. And I can imagine my parents weren't too pleased about it. So
yeah.
And what we worked out was that I actually, because of my sport, I really spent too much time on sport. And when I wasn't on sport, I was dreaming about sport. So I wasn't really focused on
academics.
I couldn't get why the academic studies were relevant and what use they'd be for me.
Sure.
And I never really thought I'd be a professional sportsman, although I was in the end, in effect. But I never, I suppose I did have those dreams, yeah. Playing in the back garden with a tennis ball and pretending I was Jimmy Greaves, famous striker for Tottenham, scoring goals. I'd announce myself through the game, score goals at each end. It was always me. So, yeah, I had these, I suppose, hopes of making it big. But this was a problem. One O-level means that you're really out of school.
Yeah.
Or you get a bit of a break, and I got that break because of the sport. Because I played at all levels. Of rugby, soccer, and cricket. And we were a very good school at what we did. We had a nucleus of five or six people that were good at each of these different sports and basketball. And so we dominated Hertfordshire, which is, again, it's a county, but like a state. We dominated a lot of the sports. And the headmaster didn't want to necessarily lose me because of the sports side, but at the same time was pragmatic to say, we got to sort something out here.
Yeah.
Because you can't go into the sixth form without some more of a plan than we've currently got, which is a zero plan. It's one O level. So my parents, with some discussion with him, he was very, he ran it like a public school. You guys would call it private. We called it public school. He ran it like a public school over there. We all wore straw hats in the sixth form, a school uniform, purple, ties. He wore a mortarboard and a cloak. You know, it was just like a public school, okay. Just like you'd imagine Oxford or Cambridge.
Okay.
So they hatched an evil plan, which was to, which was to send me to something called careers analysts, which not a lot of people have heard about. But you you go through a series of aptitude tests, and you are tested for everything from engineering to art, you know, whether you're an artist or, and what your aptitude is. It's not necessarily an intelligence test, quite the contrary. It's really, what have you got aptitudes for?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go through a morning of interviews with various people the next day, and your parents come in for some of those. And then there's, at the end of the second day, you sit down with the principal of your particular case and discuss the results, which they've got from the previous day, and where that points you in terms of a career. And they quickly said, as you've obviously observed, Nancy, journalism no good, not a good enough writer, and vocabulary a little bit, you know, stilted.
You just need a little editing, that's all.
Okay, right. That's what they said.
Yeah.
But don't make it your day job. So So that was, that kind of threw that one out. And then teacher training. Yeah, great. You'd probably be really good at it, but you'd lose interest very quickly because you're too ambitious. You like the persuasive side of things, and so you'd be frustrated quickly. Plus, you like to teach people who are interested in the sport, not the ones that aren't, and that would be a problem being a teacher.
Oh, sure.
So that was a good observation, because I could have gone down that path very quickly with very limited exams because I had proven sports ability. And then the third one was business. And the reason I'd not really given that too much thought is because my dad was in business. He was a very successful sales manager for a bedding factory, which you may have heard of, called Slumberland. And they were quite big in the UK. And so he ran the Southern England factory as well as being the sales director for it. So they came up with, you need to go into business. You come out high on persuasiveness, you're energetic about what you do, you're passionate, you have the aptitude to be strategic and look at things, and you've certainly got an aptitude towards marketing because it is strategic. You like consumer brands and products. And so it checked a lot of the boxes for going into business with marketing. And so then they gave me a plan. But if you want to do that, if you let back into the sixth form, you've got to forget about, you've got to focus on a couple of things and forget about some others. So you can retake six O levels, so you can get you up to seven, but instead of doing three A levels, which is what most people do when they go into the sixth form, you'll just take two. So that your front year will be very, you know, will be heavy to retake those other O levels and study two A levels, but the second year will get easier. And if you can do that, then you should go on and do a business management degree. And it was a three-year course. So, and that's so. To answer your question, that's what I did. It was.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate because I could have just got caught up in sport and not really found what I wanted to do.
Yeah, I think that's there should be more kind of career analyzing, and that with the aptitudes at a younger age. I think
I agree, and I think some schools are good at it, and it's got better than it used to be. But when I was at school, they really knew about the police force and the army, and that was it.
Okay, yeah,
or teacher training,
right?
Because they were teachers.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has changed considerably, but I don't think it's changed.
Okay. Yeah. So then you're out of school, you launched into your 20s, and where was the first place you worked?
Somebody said to me I should, before I went into pure marketing, I should do sales first so that you understood what it was like to sell so that you could support, because really marketing is about supporting sales. So, and that was good advice. At least it seemed so at the time. But
you don't think so now?
Well, yeah, it was, but it just made it very more difficult for me to get into marketing later, and I didn't realize that would be an issue.
Oh,
but
sure.
We'll come to that probably.
Yeah.
So the sales thing was the good thing about sales, by the way, is you got a company car. So, wow, I need to buy a car. This is cool. So I applied. I wrote intentionally to six companies that I respected and I knew would give me good training. I didn't want to join anybody and go out loose. One of the things about me is I'm very process driven. I like to have a process. It's important.
Yeah.
So I have my own processes. Anybody I work with, I help them have processes. It gives me clarity to what I do and how I do it.
Mm-hmm.
I use digital productivity tools to help me do that sort of thing, like your to-do list, but they're all categorized based on David Allen's getting things done. So very process-driven. So I wrote to six companies. Procter & Gamble was one of them. Reckitt & Coleman, Heinz, Cadbury's, Bendix, which was a small chocolate manufacturer. See, I actually remember who they were. This is incredible. And I can't remember the six, but anyway.
Quite a few.
And I got four come and talk to us interviews, which was great. So I did. And I ended up joining Cadbury's for a couple of reasons. One is their training was the most extensive. It was 6 weeks before they even let you loose to go out and sell. My parents at the time ran what we called a CTN, Confectionery Tobacconist and News Agent. So they ran like a 7-Eleven.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And it was very successful. So they were in the chocolate business, so to speak. And so I had an affinity with the product, knew about it, And that probably helped me with the interview, I would think.
Sure.
But anyway, I ended up joining them and went off to Bourneville, which is where Cadbury's headquarters were, and I believe still are, up in the north of England, actually Midlands, halfway up England. And had 6 weeks intensive training there, and then they kind of let me loose. And I ended up going back down to London, to the East End of London, to operate as a merchandiser. So if you can imagine retail stores like Target, where they have these end aisles where you check out, yeah. There's all these confectionery displays, right? And there's a reason for that.
They're tempting you to buy
it's
more.
It's impulse purchase.
Yeah.
Confectionery is 70% impulse purchase. So my job was to, in those confectionery tobacconist newsagents that we just talked about, is get stands, which we'd put in on a free basis, as close as possible to the checkout and display them with our products. And so that was it. It was a merchandising job. And that's what I did for the first year or so.
And then you kept moving along in the business, or did you move on to another company?
I got promoted at 22, I think it was, the youngest sales rep for Cadbury's nationally. So that was exciting. And I took over an area, which was in London. And after a year, realized in those days, you had to wait till you were probably 35 before you'd get promoted. Things were like that then. And yeah. I was in a bit of a hurry. I didn't want to wait around. I felt that I deserved to be promoted to another position. And I was willing to wait, but if I was given a plan for two or 3 years, that would be fine. But there was no such thing. So I met a mate of mine who introduced me to a role as a sales representative for Southern England for Samuel Smith's Brewery. So my second love after sport, beer. So I ended up joining them, and then I moved to a dairy company and was a national account manager for a while, and that was great because it gave me specialization on how to work with clients and what's needed. And we sold a lot of cheese into Marks and Spencer's, which is a major chain in the UK, very high level, would be Whole Foods type.
Okay.
As an equivalent. Yeah.
So you were starting to get then some experience in kind of how to grow, to watching companies kind of grow.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Both that and finding ways of of establishing relationships and building.
Yeah. And then, so you're around what, 26, 27, mm-hmm. and there's another opportunity that came up.
Yeah, my parents... who knew that I wanted to move on, because I'd been with a non-branded product, cheese and dairy, which is some's branded, but very little of it. I wanted to get back onto brands. And of course, I was still pursuing this marketing. So I was still in sales at the time. And I went home on a weekend and they cut this thing out of the Daily Telegraph, which is a big newspaper in England. And it was an advert for a national account manager for Coca-Cola. And I went, they won't be interested in me, surely, because I haven't, you know. And they said, go for it. I said, all right, I will. all right, mum and dad, if you say so. And so I applied for it, and cut a long story short, there was a lot of candidates. I think they interviewed over 50. And so I got it, yeah. So and little did I realize how important it was at the time for what would happen in the future, yeah.
And at that time, what was going on in your personal life?
I just got married to a lady from Wales named Jane, and getting that job was the catalyst to move into London. We were living on the outskirts, a suburb, if you like, to move into London in an apartment that most dogs at kennels would probably be larger than. It was quite small.
Okay.
It was London, right on the river, fabulous view. But it was like looking through a porthole. The windows were small.
Yeah.
But it was in London and it was on the river. And so it was a big deal to move into London. It was in Chiswick, right on Hammersmith Bridge. So, and it was 10 minutes from where I worked.
Okay.
So that was a big move. So, plus the marriage is obviously a big move. Yeah.
Yeah. And so your life started taking shape.
Yeah, I suppose it did really. Yeah, I really was on a career. You know, the career was moving quite well now. I got promoted within 2 years. And I started traveling. That's when I started to travel. So not very far, but over to Vienna. I went up to Norway and Sweden, down to Spain. So, yeah, my taste for travel started and business for travel, yeah. Hmm.
Now, at the time, were you playing any sports?
Mm, of course. What would it be without sports? Yeah, we skipped a bit there where at 16, I was playing for for Watford Juniors, which is a professional club. They are in the Premier League right now. They weren't in those days. And I was spotted and asked to play some games for an academy, Tottenham Hotspur's academy. And so ended up tasting professional soccer, which was pretty exciting. Now, in those days, it didn't pay anything like it does now. And so at about 17, my parents, while I was going through this whole, what do I do next? They're like, now this is just another sign of why you're not getting your exams down. So they took me out of the program so that I could, and said, you can go back to it after you get your qualifications. Doesn't really work like that.
Yeah.
When you're 18, they're taking kids now in the English Premier League. They're taking, and throughout Europe, they're taking kids at 7. Signing them up to clubs at 7 years old.
Wow, So
even in those days, 18 was going to be a bit late. So, yeah, I carried on playing, though. I then played semi-professional, which is actually a good standard football, as we call it. And I played for a team called Red Hill, and we won several divisions while I was playing with them. And then I carried on playing semi-professionally right until until I left the country, in fact, yeah. So, yeah, big sport. But I concentrated on soccer by then.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so focusing in on one sport really
made a
difference.
Yeah, I did
a bit
of cricket, but it was kind of, if I was asked to play, it wasn't with a team. It wasn't a regular thing by then.
Sure. Well, let's finish out our first conversation let's see. So when did you move to Bahrain?
That was 1983. So we do the maths on that. I was what? 31 or something, 32.
Yeah.
And so, that was a fairly interesting story in as much as I was really enjoying working at Coke, but I wanted to move into marketing and I was stuck in a sales area. So obviously asked several times and the answer was, we'll broaden you out later. And again, showing my impatience, I loved the job I did, but it was not where I wanted to be. And so completely, I didn't even go out looking because, first of all, I was too busy traveling and doing the job I did. I didn't have time to go out and look. And secondly, I really didn't know what I would be looking for. It would have probably come to that. But out of the blue, I got one of those phone calls that you hear about, which is, you know, hi, we represent so-and-so. We've got a job as a marketing manager based in the Middle East. Do you know anybody that would be interested? You know, classic headhunter approach.
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah, I think I might. Me. So they said, okay, are you in a position to talk now or should we ring you later? And so cut a long story short, I ended up interviewing for it. Actually, the first thing that happened was I said, where is it located? So they told me, and it was Bahrain. So I wrote it down. And whilst we're talking, I'm trying to find a map on my computer to locate where the hell Bahrain was.
Right.
And I wasn't quick enough. But anyway, went home and told my wife, who had flown with Iran Air, so based out of UK, she was flying to Tehran and to New York with Iran Air, and she was based out of Gatwick Airport. And I said to her, listen, I had this call today. I think it's a really interesting opportunity. What do you think? And she said, where is it? I said, Bahrain. She said, let's go. If you get that job, we're going a heartbeat. That's a great place to be. You have a great lifestyle. It's very Western in many ways. So she knew a lot more about it than I did. So I went through the whole interview and it stymied for a while, but finally they offered me the job. And they offered it to me. They couldn't have done it in a better way. At the Beau Rivage Hotel, which is one of the most beautiful hotels probably in the world, in Lausanne, Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And we were having lunch and they said, well, you know, you've been through the series of interviews, we'll offer you the opportunity to join us. I kind of went, where do I sign? So, yeah.
Yeah, and that so was with Philip Morris?
That was with Philip Morris, yeah. So Philip Morris gave me the opportunity that I ideally hoped Coca-Cola would have done. And so that's what took me to the Middle East. And that changed my whole career again.
Oh, well, this is a good place, like a little cliffhanger, I know, to end our conversation here. And would you like to finish, continue your story in another episode?
I'd love to.
Yeah, great. All right. Well, thanks so much for putting yourself on the line for this conversation and being so open to talk about your background, because it's, I think it's really helpful for other people to gather the nuggets in each person's background to see how they pulled their life together and what were the connecting points at each place that helped them build their career to the next level. All right. So, and also thanks Mike Cabea, sound technician, photographer, videographer, mon frère, brother from another mother. All right. And thanks everybody for tuning in. I am so excited for our next conversation. I bet you are too. So I just want you to make sure that you know that We Mentor is an innovative mentoring community where small business owners build seven-figure businesses and become the leaders that they envision themselves to be. Reveal and connect with who you are as you design your business. You can subscribe to this podcast at wementor.com if you haven't already. You can also get one-on-one mentoring, attend a mini lab, or join a leadership lab where you can grow yourself while you grow your business and become the leader that you envision yourself to be. So take action today. Make this a memorable Monday, because when you work with Nancy, that's me, your life just gets a little better. All right. See you next Monday.